It's hard to imagine, but 60 years ago, only about 50% of elderly Americans had some type of hospital insurance. But that all changed when President Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid into law.
What Lyndon Johnson did uniquely, but perhaps not uniquely, but certainly distinctly, was he had this ability to persuade. And so much of that came from what was legendarily known as the Johnson treatment. Johnson had an ability to get people on his side by horse trading or cajoling or threatening or flattering or whatever he needed to do.
Our guest to discuss the 60th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid is Mark Updegrove. He's the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and the presidential historian for ABC News.
You can learn a lot about who we are and where we're going by looking at our history.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Mark Updegrove, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. Delighted to be here.
Oh, that's great. And let's just start off by asking you really to get in the Wayback Machine back to 1965. What was healthcare like for elderly Americans and how did they pay for it? And maybe talk a little bit about how severe was the economic burden for seniors.
Tremendously severe. In 1965, one third of America's population over 65 lived in poverty. LBJ, among other things, is known for the war on poverty, the war he waged on poverty in our nation. And one of those things necessitated ensuring that Americans who couldn't afford the most basic health care needs could do so through an insurance policy allowed through Medicare. And so it's something that Harry Truman had tried to push up the hill. Wasn't able to do so. John F. Kennedy did so as well. But Lyndon Johnson got it done in 1965, and it's been woven into the fabric of our country ever since.
Well, let's set the scene by talking a little bit about what was happening in the country six decades ago. Those were interesting times, just like these are interesting times. The U.S. had just elected Lyndon Johnson as president in his own right following John F. Kennedy's assassination. He was really at the height of his political power in a long political life. Tell us, who was he at that point, as you've come to know and understand him through history?
You know, you're absolutely right, Margaret. 1965 is the high tide of the Great Society and of the Johnson administration. He, of course, takes over as president in the wake of the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. He rides out that year as an accidental president, becomes elected in his own right. In 1964, with the largest electoral mandate in American history, 61% of the popular vote, rides into the White House with this mandate, and he knows the ephemeral nature of political capital. So he uses 1965 to get as much done as he possibly can. And during the course of that year, you see the creation of Head Start and VISTA, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Highway Beautification Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Immigration Act, the most sweeping immigration reform in the history of our country, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the Higher Education Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the creation of Medicare and Medicaid.
Wow.
And that is one year.
Wow.
Of the Johnson presidency. It's stunning.
Well, you know, Margaret, I had the chance to read Robert Caro's four books on Johnson. And Mark, you know, he really was able to use his political strength to push through so many things, but in particular, the federal health insurance program. And that, as you said earlier, that was really a legacy that others had tried to get through. How did he do it?
You know, let me just go back for a moment and mention again that Truman had really pushed hard for this.
Yeah.
And I think you had the resistance of the medical community, the doctors in particular. They thought they were going to lose money if you went to a federal, you know, what they considered social medicine. John F. Kennedy, the year of his death, had a huge rally at Madison Square Garden to push for Medicare. Lyndon Johnson did it for a number of reasons. Number one, he was a student of power. I think he understood intrinsically the way that power worked, and he could work on lawmakers in a way that Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy could not. He just had this great ability to get things done. Number two, I think it was an idea whose time had come. You had two-thirds majorities, Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate. And there was this confluence of circumstances that made it possible for progressive reform like that to go into place, despite the violent resistance of so many Republicans, and including a Republican named Ronald Reagan, who had yet to be the governor of California and president of the United States, but was a very active voice in the Republican Party, and said that it would be the ruin of America to see something like Medicare and Medicaid go through. It would lead to greater socialism in our nation.
Well, major legislation like this that is durational, long-lasting, changes over time. When you look back to the founding, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, what did it look like compared to what it looks like today?
Well, a lot smaller. But let me just say, Margaret, that I mentioned those things that Lyndon Johnson was able to do in 1965. I also mentioned the war on poverty. That was one of his objectives. Another objective was racial equality. And this is the guy who had pushed for the Civil Rights Act in 1964, spent a great deal of political capital to get that through. The Voting Rights Act came, as I mentioned, in 1965. But so much of Medicare at the time was to ensure greater equality in this country. There was a desegregation of hospitals that was embedded in the Medicare Act. Black Americans had far less longevity than white Americans, and the healthcare needs were so much greater for people of color than they were for white people in this nation. So there were those things that were crucial to this as well. But the Medicare and Medicaid, as any big legislation does, it evolves through time. And so the Medicare and Medicaid envisioned by and enacted by Lyndon Johnson became much greater through time as our needs as a nation became greater.
You know, I really want to pull up on that thought about evolving, because who would have thought back then that Medicaid would loom so large in our country today, right? 90, 100 million Americans, 68 or so on Medicare, still important, but you see this popularity of Medicaid, and was it an afterthought? How did Medicaid get put into the Medicare bill?
I think it was very much a product of the war on poverty, Mark. Uh-huh. As I mentioned earlier, the heavy concentration on the alleviation of poverty in our country, which was chronic, about between a fifth and a quarter of Americans lived in poverty. And as I mentioned, a third of Americans over 65 lived in poverty. That number was far greater for people of color. It was far greater for rural Americans. So you had these major factors that had Johnson not only concentrating on Medicare, but the Medicaid program, which I don't think Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy had imagined quite to the degree that Lyndon Johnson had.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly all major legislation has its fierce opponents, and these programs were no exception. You called out Ronald Reagan a little while ago and said that Ronald Reagan said that the Medicare idea would be a step towards socialized medicine in this country.
On September 1st, 1964, Senator Barry M. Goldwater interrupted his vacation cruise and headed for shore in a big hurry. Destination, Washington, D.C. He arrived just in time to cast his vote. No. Then he turned around and headed back. Senator Goldwater flew across the continent twice, almost 6,000 miles, to vote against a program of hospital insurance for older Americans. As he said in the Atlanta Constitution on January 26, 1963, I've got my own Medicare plan. I've got an intern for a son-in-law. Flip answers do not solve the problems of human beings. President Johnson wants a program of hospital insurance for older Americans. He is determined to see this program passed in the next Congress. Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
You know, historically, we've seen continued attacks like this. How did he respond to that? Was it just politically get the majority and push it through? Or was there a reasoned argument that he was putting forth that said, no, this is not socialized medicine. It's still private, it's still going to be privatized. There was no call within, as I understand it, within the Medicare legislation to take control away from physicians. It was very much about actually opening up an entire new kind of line of reimbursement for physicians and hospitals, wasn't it, across the country?
That's exactly right, Margaret. So there's a lot of education, as there is with any big bill that's transformational. You have to educate lawmakers, you have to educate lobbyists, you have to educate constituents. And I think there was a concerted effort to do that. There was also actions on the other side to do the same thing. You had doctors' wives holding coffees and playing records of Ronald Reagan, as I mentioned earlier, talking about what an evil Medicare would be and how it would lead to socialism in our country. So you had educational efforts and propaganda efforts on both sides. But I think what Lyndon Johnson did uniquely, perhaps not uniquely, but certainly distinctly, was he had this ability to persuade. And so much of that came from what was legendarily known as the Johnson treatment. Johnson had an ability to get people on his side by horse trading or cajoling or threatening or flattering or whatever he needed to do to get something over the finish line. And he had an uncanny ability to do that, which explains the litany of transformational legislation that I enumerated a moment ago.
He would physically get in people's space as well. So he used...
He was big.
He was big. He would use many, many, many tactics. You know, talked a little bit about the sort of the opponents have really tried to shape the debate over time, really claiming the program will lead to sort of economic disaster. And we've heard from the American Enterprise Institute, their projections really at the turn of the century, 1999, that Medicare would reach insolvency in the next two decades. I think that's been trotted out for many decades. That didn't happen. Is it in part just because of how popular it is and that Congress is always going to find a way to keep this afloat?
I think that's right. And there's the concern among Republicans about big government. That's always been a plank in the party. That's always been something that they have beat the drum on, reducing the size of government. It's ironic because you see with the so-called big, beautiful bill that it makes our government in some ways much bigger, certainly makes our debt much bigger, and it cuts Medicare and Medicaid substantially while giving the wealthiest Americans a major tax cut. So it is in some ways antithetical. But paradoxical. But I think once again, we see those programs, Medicare and Medicaid, under siege.
You know, if I think back to the Affordable Care Act run-up summers, remember all the town halls with seniors their placards?
No
government health insurance. Keep your hands off my Medicare. Medicare had come to be seen as the private insurance and a really positive benefit, like getting Social Security. Interestingly, we've never seen that kind of public support from all people for Medicaid, right? Medicare, it's like hands off. Medicaid still remains unequal among the states. Do you think that was something that would have surprised or disappointed Johnson to look across the states and see how much variation there is based on where you live in this country? Your access to Medicare is pretty much the same, assuming you have providers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But your access to Medicaid is not the same. There's been a different level of state intervention. What would he have made of that, do you think?
I think surprised, no, Margaret, but disappointed, yes. Surprised, no, because you were seeing the same thing really related to civil rights in particular. Look at, you know, segregation at right. The time. You had the Deep South, which was behaving very differently from other states. And so there was a certain sectional differences. But disappointed, yes, because there are a lot of people who could benefit from Medicaid. And for instance, in Texas, where I I live and where I work, we have a government that has refused Medicaid to the detriment of many of its poorest citizens. So Johnson, a Texan, certainly would have been disappointed by that as well.
What do you think about that? Because, you know, Texas is a great example. I think there are, Margaret, only 10 states that haven't signed up for the ACA, Florida and Texas being the two biggest ones. But Mark, probably $10-20 billion lost for the hospital system, the private providers in the state. And then as you looked at this sort of assault on Medicaid now, there's been some really interesting congressional district by congressional district of the percentage of Medicaid people. And you look at some of these much poorer states from West Virginia, swath on down through the South, where there's, you know, huge amounts of dollars coming into their state and obviously people in need. What do you make of why there's a disconnect in the minds of the people who are opposed to that, in many cases, Republicans? It sort of doesn't make a lot of sense. They're not voting in their self-interest. This isn't the small proportion that happened in the late 60s or early 70s in terms of Medicaid's impact. This has been an enormous sea change.
You know, I think a lot of it is our information ecosystem, which I think is the longest or the biggest long-term threat to our democracy. There is this conservative media ecosystem where audiences are being served up misinformation, disinformation relating to the federal government, which has been vilified and demonized. A big government has been attacked, and whether it is beneficial to the folks who are consuming those programs or not. And I think a lot of people are, because of that misinformation and disinformation, again, to your point, Mark, voting against their own interests. That's nothing new. But given the fact that there is such a fragmented media landscape, I think the ability to purvey, to serve up misinformation and disinformation is much greater.
I think they had some realization, because in the bill they pushed all of the cuts past the midterm elections, right? Most people were asking, I know we get asked all the time, Margaret, how's the organization going to be impacted by the Medicaid cuts? And I got to remind them and say, it really happens in January 2027, a little after the midterms.
That's right. That's exactly right. And of course, the timing of that is not coincidental, right?
Right.
So it's unfortunate. And again, I look at the media landscape as a major culprit here as well.
You know, it's so great to have a chance to talk to you with your depth of knowledge of this period in time when all this was happening. And though I hadn't planned on it, let me take the opportunity to ask you. It's this time of the signing, 1968. It's also the time of the creation of the community health centers in the United States, the beginning of the movement, which we've been part of for half a century. Sergeant Shriver authorizes some of the OEO demonstration projects, and the statute that ultimately created community health centers get signed into law. Do you think that figured anywhere in his thinking as well, that there needed to be a delivery system to make sure that poor people in particular had access to health care, or was that all being handled by other people and he was razor focused on the Medicare and Medicaid bills writ large? Just curious if you have any insights into that.
No, I think this is part of LBJ's sweeping vision for a better America. I mean, all this stuff was interwoven. You know, we tend to look at the great society in different categories. There's health care, and there's education, and there's immigration and civil rights and poverty alleviation. But ultimately, if you look at the legislation itself, I alluded to this with Medicare a moment ago, all this stuff is interwoven, right? There's a major poverty component in Medicare. There's a major race component in Medicare. There's a major education component.
Exactly. Right? Another big piece of it.
Jimmy. Yep.
Right.
Right.
Right. So he's thinking in a big way about all this stuff.
Bring him
back. It factors into the legislation. Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think someone who spoke truth to power all the time, he was a real champion so many things, such a consequential president. And we shouldn't forget that in 1965, President Johnson also signed the Older Americans Act into law. Maybe talk a little bit about what the law covered and how does it affect the health of seniors today?
So Medicare was part of it, right? Ensuring that the older Americans who couldn't afford it could have the most basic health care needs met. But there were other needs that older Americans had that weren't embedded in Medicare. So there were a number of measures that he took to ensure that older Americans were being thought of, that we were thinking about the elderly community. He used to talk about LBJ, that when he was young, people would go over to the poorhouse. And effectively what that meant was that there was an older member of a household who had health care needs that weren't being met, and they would essentially send them someplace to die. That was almost a dying center, right? It was hospice care before that term was readily known. And so he saw many people going over to the poorhouse because they couldn't afford to be tended to. Sure. And so the aim of his administration, or the aim of these efforts around the elderly Americans, were not just about healthcare, but other aspects of tending to our elderly and in the American, throughout America.
Yeah, that
expression, the poorhouse, remember growing up. Yeah.
You've all heard that. And I think that term to some degree evolved.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was about something very specific. It was a euphemism for essentially sending an elderly member of your family out to die. Mm-hmm.
Well, you recently released a new book titled Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from Seven Presidents. And it includes a chapter about George W. Bush's work to start the PEPFAR program, which provides, as we all know, HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment and care to people in developing countries. Tell us, so much out there. Why did you pick this topic to include, and what lessons should we take from this section?
The Greeks said 2,500 years ago that character was destiny. Mm-hmm. And I think that sentiment rings as true today as it ever has. And it's particularly true in our leadership. We need character in our leaders to ensure that we are on the right course. Character is the rudder that directs a leader's actions and decisions. And we're not seeing it. In my personal view, we're not seeing a great deal of character from, we're certainly not seeing a great deal of compassion from our president today. But the quality that I highlighted for George Walker Bush is about giving back. And that is very much instilled in the ethos of the Bush family. You've had it good in this country, and there's the biblical proverb that George W. Bush adhered to whom much is given, much is required. Mm-hmm. And during the beginning part of the millennium, the AIDS epidemic was ravaging much of the world, including in particular sub-Saharan Africa, where it threatened to wipe out certain sects of the population. And Bush realized he could do something about it. And that led to the creation of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which since it went into place in 2003 has saved the lives of over 28 million citizens of the world. That's more than the population of Australia for a relatively minimal investment. So that's a great example of giving back. And it's something that we should be aware of, something that we should be proud of and should continue to sustain.
Margaret, you remember last year we were at Aspen Institute, had the opportunity to sit with Tony Fauci on the anniversary of PEPFAR. And he told a great story about W in terms of he got him in his office. He said, what do you think this is going to cost? And Tony sort of used a little number. He said, Tony, you go over to Africa and figure out if we can solve this problem. Let me worry about the money. So he was really very committed to this. Didn't matter the size. He just knew the importance of it. And I'd also say, probably surprising on the community health center world, he was a big supporter, which, sort of came out of the blue for many people in the movement. But he was also realized, and probably just growing up, in Texas and realizing the importance of taking care of the people who you represent. So character really mattered, and we saw a lot of that in his actions. You know, Mark, you've had a varied career, including leadership roles in media. Why is presidential history so important to you, and why do you think it matters?
You know, I was, as it happens, Mark, I was at the Harry Truman Library yesterday in Independence, Missouri, right outside of Kansas City. And Harry Truman said something which I've quoted often. He said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know." And you can learn a lot about who we are and where we're going by looking at our history. I think it's, you can see it in particular in our presidential history. Again, because of the character of our leaders, we've seen our country steered in certain directions, making certain pivotal decisions based on the American values that we represent, that America is known for. So I think the history has always been of great interest to me, and I think to a large extent, we can see our future by looking at our past.
You know, you talked about a moment we're pivoting now, and I'm wondering, is there anything from the Johnson history in terms of how we bring people back together? Certainly, there's been a fragmentation that's existed in the political landscape. What's the local anecdote to what may be, very rough winds coming out of Washington?
Well, there are two things. One of the things that folks, I think, should know is that, those programs I enumerated, the 1965 legislation, that's just 1965. But if you look at the accomplishments of the Great Society, they're much greater than that. Mm-hmm. That's the high tide of the Great Society, but they go on and on. And we hear about the eradication of government from the Trump administration, and he's often vilifies Joe Biden or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, even George W. Bush. But at the end of the day, the eradication of government is principally about the elimination of a lot of the programs that came in the Great Society. That's what's at stake here. The Great Society was in large measure the foundation of modern America. So much that has been woven into the fabric of our nation was in those that legislation that I mentioned. I think LBJ had a phrase that I loved. He used to invoke a phrase that was that he had learned in his youth, and that is any jackass can kick down a barn door, but it takes a damn fine carpenter to build one. Mm-hmm. And I think what you see singularly throughout the Johnson administration is this effort to build a better America. Some things succeeded, some things failed, but we did become, I think, ultimately a better country because of the things that were enacted in the 1960s. I see a lot of destruction today. I see a lot of the tearing down of things, but I don't see a vision for what we can build in place toward a better America. And that's something I'd like to see in the days, months, and years ahead.
As would we. Mark Updegrove, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare. And thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and share your thoughts and comments about this program. We love to hear from you. Take care and be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.